So welcome to today's compiler construction. Last time we've been extensively dealing with the issue of encountering conflicts in LR canonical automata, and we discussed the typical ways of dealing with them in the sense of, for once you would introduce things like associativity or precedences of your symbols, and if that is not enough, then there's the idea of somehow trying to get rid of the conflict by manipulating the situation in which these conflicts are actually occurring, in the sense that if you have something like a LR2 grammar but only want to use an LR1 parser generator with that, then you would try to pull the decisive terminal symbol nearer to the start of the look-ahead window in order to be able to decide about reducing or shifting, in some cases, based on the now nearer symbol. And for that, we had seen several examples of how that could be achieved in practice, and you see the result of this idea in the second example in that slide, where you can see that this tiny original grammar has been transformed into something more larger over here, but which is then possible to be parsed with an LR1 parser instead of an LR2 parser. So what I promised you last time was that I would give you a more formal definition of how this algorithm actually works, and here it is. So you start off with a rule for which you know that it is reduce conflicting under a certain terminal symbol. You might ask yourself, how could you obtain such information? Well, you get that by error messages of your parser generator, or, well, if you're more into the details, by checking the final states of the canonical automaton and comparing the complete items or the incomplete items, depending on what kind of conflict you're looking at. And from there you can read which rule is actually involved and what terminal is the one that is conflicting here. So that is your input for that algorithm. So what you do with that thing is then you inspect your grammar and step by step transform the productions that you find in that grammar. So it all depends on how the productions look like, especially how the right-hand sides of the productions in your grammar look like. So what you're particularly interested in that respect is if your rule looks like A goes to some alpha, you're interested in right-hand sides that at some point have an occurrence of that particular large A. So this one, and this one have a large A in there. So what do you do with those? If you find another rule, like this one over here, and you already know that the rule with which you started was reduce conflicting, and you see that the terminal that it could be reduced to is occurring as a very last symbol of the right-hand side, you will know that this reduce conflict will probably carry over to that production also, because well, this also needs to be reduced at some point, and if that's that is probably depending on the same criterion as the one before. And yeah, with that you would have to run the algorithm again with the newly found production here, that is B goes to some beta and A. So that one would also have to be considered as reduced conflicting under the same terminal and would have to go through this algorithm. The next situation that you find your A in might be something like this, where you have some prefix beta, some postfix gamma, which is not that interested. Not that interesting here. The more interesting thing is what comes directly after the A, and in this case, it would be non-terminal. This is one of the situations which, when you think back to your kind of tree representation of an input, where you get the connection from your conflicting spot that bridges over to the to the occurrence of the terminal under which the whole thing conflicts, and the purpose of that thing here would be to transform this right-hand side in a form that you explicitly pull the conflicting symbol up to the spot where this A and C connects. Thus, what you would have to do is you would have to introduce one of these right context extracted Cs. So how does it look like? You would transform your original production into an alternative one, where you have made it explicit that the symbol X might appear directly after A. And to account for that, you would have to somehow signify that in the following subtree, the X doesn't appear anymore at the beginning. So you pull out the X from the C and put it directly where it might occur. And since it's not necessarily the case that X always precedes everything that is yielded by C, you need to account for also other possibilities that might be out there. And in particular, you would need to take care that all the symbols that might be yielded as first symbols of C are made explicit too as alternatives to this X, because, well, if you pull something out, there might also be something else be pulled out from there. So you also pull out all the other symbols and make them explicit. So with that, you generate a lot of new non-terminals that pull out terminals from subtrees. And that is done with an algorithm that follows in the next slide, which is then this right context extraction algorithm. But for now, for this kind of connecting algorithm, we just consider that to be sufficient. So with that, you have removed all the productions with a right-hand side pattern like this, and instead added ones that have the conflicting terminal made explicit like that. So the next pattern that you need to take care of is this one over here. Well, maybe let's remove those and just talk about this one, where the conflicting terminal is made explicit as the right context of a symbol. And this now corresponds to this intuition that in the tree, when you have moved the conflicting terminal to the common root of the reduced conflicting rule and the actual input symbol, you need to push it down back again to the actual conflicting the conflicting rule. And that is done with so-called right context propagation. And this would once again alter the productions in the sense that the rules where you have the X is an explicit right context of an A would then be rewritten to new rules where we take away this X and push it down into the right-hand sides of the A production. And that is done by, once again, introducing an artificial non-terminal, in this case this AX, and is actually then performed by this right context propagation algorithm, which we also find on the next slide. So there's a lot of rules to be added to the grammar, and we see how they look like on the next slide. So there's the right context propagation algorithm. So in order to obtain the rules that are created by introducing the AX, what you do is you consider all the alternatives for right-hand sides that you might find for a particular non-terminal and inspect each of them and disambiguate two cases. One, where you kind of have the right recursive version of the right-hand side, where A goes to something and is ending with A once again. That is a situation where you get a kind of a recursive propagation of the of this conflicting terminal, and since you only want to add one instance of that terminal and not one for each of the recursive cases, you actually replace this A in the right hand side not with AX but with with this newly introduced non-terminal AX and not with A and X separately. So you don't do something like gamma AX, but instead what you do is you introduce this bracketed version. And only for the cases that are actually terminating, which means that they don't have an A as the last symbol of the right-hand side, you just append the X to the end. So that would be, in case of such lists, that would be the terminating alternative. And for those, you actually want to put the X in the end. Okay, then the other thing that we needed was an algorithm for performing right context extraction. So that would introduce terminals of that form here. And for those, we actually need to pull terminals out of the right-hand side. So once again, what we do is we switch cases between the different patterns of right-hand sides that might occur in alternatives for this B. And now let's look at them. What might be occurring there? Well, we might find that at the very left, there is another non-terminal. And since we don't, we can't specifically remove a single terminal here, what we need to do is we need to perform this write context extraction on that one too. So we introduce a rule that looks like this new x extracted from B goes to x now extracted from C, and the usual postfix that's after this one. Yeah, this might even have to cascade to other symbols from within this postfix in case that C actually can produce the empty string, but that is something that I have omitted from that description over here. Just see that this is probably missing here. Apart from that, what you have is the cases where this X is explicitly the prefix of a right-hand side of one of these alternatives. In that case, we just remove the X from this alternative and terminate. And there's a possibility where there's actually no X to take away here. And in that case, we simply terminate without any addition. We simply continue with the other alternatives that are out there, because this Y is definitely not an X, so we can't chip away an X from the beginning, and we consider the case where I is in the beginning to be handled by all the other write context extracted symbols. So yeah, that's that. Good. So that is a rough overview on what you can actually do in order to transform your grammar from a larger look-ahead window needed to a smaller look-ahead window needed. With that, at least in case you don't have any questions anymore to the chapter of bottom-up syntax recovery, syntax parsing. Then let's do a summary on everything. So, all in all, we have spent a lot of time in bottom-up parsing on LR1 parsing. Most of our examples have been LR1, except for those that were on purpose something larger, which is something that has been like that a long time in all the practical examples for computer languages, at least. Most of the computer languages out there had been LR1 for a long time. Recent developments have seen a few of the major languages breaking with that in the more recent past, but it's still the case that with an LR1 parser you can parse a large fraction of the relevant computer languages out there. Apart from that, there's possibilities of how to deal with the cases in which you can't parse with an LR1 parser. Especially, there's this idea of introducing the precedences and the associativities, or even go deeper into grammar engineering and rewrite your grammar in a fashion that you can use it with an LR1 parser generator. And there's even a few approaches out there which do that automatically, such that the programmer doesn't even see any of the mess that is created by this transformation, and instead works as if he or she just had the original LR1 grammar and the insights gained by the parsing run with the transformed version would be used in order to decide the shift-reduce conflicts in the original grammar. So that would be a way of having a quite simple interface to a quite mighty tool. However, what also turns out to be is that in general the canonical automaton for an LRK automaton, well, an automaton that actually uses look-ahead of some size, has definitely more, if not even much more, states than just the plain LR0 canonical automaton. And, that is an actual issue. There's examples out there where the generation of an LR1 parser, even on hardware nowadays, is still tedious. So runtimes of that can exceed several minutes. For example, I think I had a PHP 4 or 5 grammar of some sorts that was actually in LR1 form, but needed parsing times of over, I think, parser generation times of, I think, over 5 minutes or something. So that's clearly something that you don't want to have. So there's ideas out there of of going somewhere of a middle ground between the generation of an LR0 canonical automaton and an LR1 canonical automaton, by introducing some kind of subclasses of these LRK grammars. So for those of you who are interested in that, there's this concept of the simple LRK parsing and the LA LRK parsing. And both of them have considerable smaller state space than the pure LR1 automata. The simple LRK automaton even has the same shape as the LR0 automaton. It just adds an over approximation of the contexts of the right contexts of each production in there, so that at least a few of the shift-reduce conflicts that might occur can be solved, and with that already you can express a larger set of languages than pure LR0. So simple LRK is one of the ideas out there. And then there's this LA LRK that also over approximates the look-ahead sets by joining all the look-ahead sets of I think one state, basically. So that also reduces the amount of states that are produced overall, but is still more expressive than the pure LR0 variant out there. But we won't concentrate on those two special cases here. I just want you to keep in mind that there is demand for subclasses of LRK out there, because LRK is already quite the burden in a few contexts, and these are the concepts to deal with that. So all in all, in parsing, what is if you try to relate all the parsing classes to each other in terms of expressivity, what you can actually express with all of these parsing techniques? So, well, first of all, the tiny common ground, so to say, is the regular language. Everything that you can do with finite automata. That is kind of the common ground that can be expressed with all of the other means. Then we had the top-down parsing concepts, these LLK things, and they kind of form a hierarchy, with the regular languages being included by the smallest of the LLK languages, and those things just strictly grow. Then we had the idea of bottom-up parsing, and you see the borders of the bottom-up parsing being intersecting with the top-down parsing method. So there are LL1 languages out there that are not in LR0, and the other way around, there's LR0 languages out there that can't be or that are not LL1, and so on. But all in all, the LR0 together with the SLR and the LALR classes have their own kind of hierarchy. They start with the regular languages and step up through LR0, SLR, LALR, and are then dominated by LRK, which kind of is the end of the expressivity here, and as it collapses down to LR1 languages, since, well, you've seen at least a sketch of the algorithm that is necessary to do grammar transformations, so that you can reduce the necessary look-ahead window of LRK grammars, such that they you can bring it down to a look-ahead set of look-ahead size of 1 if you repeat the algorithm over and over and over again. So in the sense of languages that are expressible with these grammars, it all collapses to just LR1 grammars, which is the same as LR2 grammar or LR3 grammar or whatever you might like in that sense. There's also the notion of LL star out there. I don't know if anyone has heard about something like that. It turns up once and again from students. No? No one? Okay, so I won't mention it then. Okay, so, but basically that is the expressivity of all the grammars compared to each other. All in all, what we had for the syntactical analysis was that for both of the phases as well as scanning, as well as syntax analysis, we had this generating approach. What we did was for lexical analysis, we went from regular expressions to finite automata, from finite automata to scanners in some way. So this should just remind a little bit what we have done so far. Then there was this concept of look-ahead sets, which we needed in order to come from the item pushdown automaton to LL1 parsers. From there, we started over and devised a way of how to parse bottom-up by introducing these characteristic and canonical automata as helper structures for the shift-reduced parser, which would then turn into the LR1 parser at some point. And that is what we have achieved so far. And with that, we would go on to the concept of semantic analysis. So, what you had so far was scanner and parser, which would accept programs with correct syntax at least. But That is usually not all what you demand from a compiler. Not all programs that are syntactically correct actually make real sense to the machine. And the compiler can do even more. Can recognize a few of the programs that are at least syntactically correct, but don't make any sense. In the sense as the compiler might generate or flag them as erroneous by some other means of errors in there. Particularly what you could expect from something like the semantic analysis in a compiler would be checks like whether an identifier has been correctly defined before usage with these kind of definition use analyses, and also whether variables have been used in a type correct fashion in your program. And if you see a program that does not, you would report a typing error. So that is a kind of a comfort for the compiler to straight away reject those programs that that don't make sense in that fashion. You might also apply something like semantic analysis in the field where you try to optimize your program, in the sense that you would try to analyze the preconditions for certain optimizations, whether they hold at a certain program point or not. Or even try to warn about certain conditions that are often leading to incorrect programs, although you can't make sure that in all instances this program will actually fail. So you might issue a warning, and that is also something that you might find out with your semantic analysis. In general, what the semantic analysis would be, it would annotate the syntax trees with so-called attributes. So what we're talking about in that chapter now is the so-called attribute grammars. That's the kind of the theoretical concept that captures most things that you would consider to be located in the semantical analysis. So, in general, what you would do in that part is you would perform computations of the syntactic analysis based on the syntax tree. What you actually do there is computing certain things different for the particular locations within your syntax tree. And the actual important point is you act differently depending on the type of the node that you're computing attributes for. So for one of these nodes, then you would all the computations that happen at that specific location you would call a local computation. What is characteristic about such a local computation would be that if you perform it, you access information from neighboring nodes as soon as they become available, or as soon as the neighboring nodes attributes are evaluated. And by computing the attributes, you then would make them available for the other neighboring nodes to perform additional computations of theirs. So it's a kind of an interaction thing between the different nodes of your syntax tree. So what you need for an attribute grammar is, well, first of all, a context-free grammar, of course, that somehow defines how your the syntax tree looks like. You would also introduce a set of attributes for each non-terminal and terminal, and with the set of attributes, I don't mean that for each terminal and non-terminal I introduce one attribute, but there might be even multiples of attributes for each of these symbols. What I also need for an attribute grammar is the local attribute equations, so the rules to follow for performing the local computation, so to say. So then there's this issue of being only able to evaluate an attribute equations if all the attributes that are referenced from my current attribute equation are already evaluated. So in trees, or in attributed trees, there's actually the typical problem of finding a sequence that is able to perform computations such that in the end you get all the attributes in your syntax tree evaluated, and that is a matter of the sequence of visitations in such tree, usually. We have seen such a computation already in the past. If you think back to the scanner, we already had the syntax tree of a regular expression available to us, and we already performed kind of local computations depending on the type of a certain node, and filled in or evaluated attributes for nodes. For example, think back, we had this case of the empty attribute for all of the nodes of the regular expressions, and if you think back, there was the idea of the sequence of a specific evaluation sequence of the of this, if you would consider it as an attributed tree, by starting from the leaves and going up to the root node step by step. So this was kind of the bottom up evaluation of the empty attribute. So the implementation, if you think back, was to attach an attribute for every node of the syntax tree. That is actually just like an attribute system. We computed or evaluated the attributes in a in the sense of global evaluation in a depth first post-order traversal manner. So that was the strategy for us to compute all or evaluate all of these attributes in the sense of computing a value for each of these things. At the leaf, we would know what the attributes would be like without considering any other nodes, but the attributes of the inner node were ones that were actually having dependencies on other nodes, specifically on their children. In that sense, the empty attribute would be considered to be a synthetic attribute, synthesized from the bottom up. In general, attribute systems can be an attribute can be called synthetic if its value is drawn from the bottom of the of its subtree. So if the information is propagated upwards in the tree, in the sense of from leaf to roof to root, and there will be the notion of inherited attributes.
in the sense that those values would be propagated from the root to the leaf. If we would have to write the attribute equations for empty down, remember what we had was this collection of equalities. Those were, to make things easier in the beginning, were specialized with directly mentioning what type of node would be there here in the brackets. In the more general lore of attribute systems, you wouldn't have that kind of specialization. So if you look in the secondary literature, you would find a form, a more generic form to refer to parents and children of subtree. So what you would do as notation would be, first of all, of course, you would somehow denote the attribute with a certain name. For us here, I have this attribute with an index k for some arbitrary attribute. And the now kind of generic part would be to introduce a numbering on all the nodes of a subtree, in the sense that you would associate the root node with the number 0 and the ith child with the number I. So the first child would be attribute would carry an attribute for number 1. If you would want to access the attribute of child 3, you would put 3 in the bracket. So nothing too complex for people who know array indexing, I would say. So if you would reformulate your empty attribute system, you could do it with this new fancy way of denoting attribute systems. And that would look like the version from over here. So you always have evaluation in a synthetic way in that sense. So what is characteristic about here is that you find that all of the attributes that are occurring at the left-hand side of these of these computations is having the 0 as the index, so it's all evaluating the roots of particular subtrees, and you get the specialization for each type of the tree in that part over here, which is occurring left of the colons. Apart from that, all you see here is that there's I made use of children of certain subtrees by indexing with 1 or 2, and that's just the more generic way of denoting that, as we have had over here in some way, of course. Okay, so overall, what we can observe by that is that the local equations by themselves don't contribute anything without all the others. So what we're after is kind of a global algorithm that knows about the dependencies within such a system, and especially about the dependencies node locally and also globally of all the nodes with each other. So in order to construct an algorithm that's able to compute all of that, what we need is a sequence in which the nodes of the tree are visited, and then again a sequence within each of the nodes which of the attributes can be evaluated then. And this evaluation strategy has to be compatible with the dependencies between attributes. So in order to reason about something like that, what we do is we visualize the attribute dependencies, or the local attribute dependencies, in a local dependency graph.
So, for example, for the case of the OR operator in the regular expressions, we would declare the local dependency graph of that as the empty of the children being dependencies for the evaluation of the empty of the root. Thus, we would introduce edges between these nodes in the direction that the information would actually flow, and thus setting up a graph which we would call the local dependency graph. And in a more formal way, we would keep the information of that graph as a collection of its edges, and an edge is nothing more than the source and the sink of the edge in terms of the attributes that are actually connected. So, and here again, we use the notation that we had in the attribute systems. So MT0 is depending on MT1, so that so we find the edge from MT1 to MT0 in there, and also we find the edge from MT2 to MT0 in there. So that is kind of the formal notation of the graphic representation on this side over here. So in order to infer an evaluation strategy, it's now necessary not only to consider the local things, but also the global dependencies of the flow between the nodes. However, it's not as easy as that because for the local dependencies, we always have fixed dependencies. If we look at the global dependencies between the nodes, then for a single tree, it's pretty easy. We would just need to connect all the local dependencies with each other and consider the graph that we get from there as all the dependency flows that are possible in there. And with that, we could probably pretty easily determine a sequence or if there exists one. In our example, that was quite an easy task, as all the dependencies that were occurring in there were actually ones where the parents would be always dependent on the children only. So it's a pretty easy case for constructing an evaluation strategy. Just go from bottom up to the root. That first post-order traversal was the solution for that. In general, that's not as easy as that. It might be more complex, especially if you introduce more than one attribute to the system. That's where all these other nice things like first, next, and even last might come into play. So, you would also throw them into our example here, and you see you get more complicated things like these dependencies over here, where you now have two instead of only one attribute involved in the whole thing, but still it's just it's not interacting with each other. They remain in their respective domain. For the leaves, it's there is not any dependency at all between those. But we also have more complicated examples where we connect between different children and parent attributes in different ways. So there's different directions in there. Like you see over here, we have on the left-hand side of a computation, we have now not only root nodes but also children's attributes. So there's different directions in which the information is flowing, so that we in that sense we get also quite large dependency graphs. And that's if that wasn't enough already, we also get instances where there's information flowing between different types of
attributes in the sense that attributes with different names are referring to each other. So now we get situations where we have first being dependent on empty, for example, which leads to, for example, the, well, it's probably not a good way of visualizing such information flows. So an E type of attribute flows into an F type. All of that goes into the local dependencies of our specific production over here. And yeah, with that, we, yeah, that's, I think, the two missing things. They're just here for completeness. So, challenges in such a system is, for example, something like, can you make sure that the plan that you have created for evaluating your attribute system is actually always going to be successful? Well, can there be situations where an evaluation strategy is not successful? Well, you need to make sure that your dependencies are, of course, acyclic. So if you have a cycle in your dependencies, well, unlike you, your evaluation strategy, or you will never be able to find an evaluation strategy. So far, so good. You might argue that, well, if you want to check your dependency graph for a cycle or not, that is a pretty easy algorithm. That's basic algorithmic challenges from the back from bachelors. Might be, but the issue here is that we're not talking about a single particular syntax tree for which we create a dependency graph, but we're talking about all possible syntax trees that can be constructed for correct inputs to our parser, and with that we get not only one syntax tree but a whole lot of them. In principle, we need to make sure that for all possible inputs and all possible syntax trees of those, we that we can make sure that there's no cycle occurring. Never for any of those syntax trees. And that is then not so easy anymore, because it's, you cannot just reason with a simple graph algorithm anymore, because you don't have graph, but you have a whole class of graphs out there. So, turns out that there is algorithms for that, but they're not as cheap as the plain detection of cycles in a graph. And in all, you have to pay a quite hefty price for assuring that there's no cycle in there. The whole problem is deterministic exponential time complete. So, yeah, that is probably not good news. Exponential algorithms are always something that bother us. So how can we circumvent that? What is out there as tools for us now in such a bad situation? Well, you could just be opportunistic and say, well, let the user specify a strategy anyway, and if it turns out to be defective, well, that's the user's fault. Yeah. So there's other situations in which such approaches are actually used in practice. You could try to determine a strategy dynamically, and for at a concrete input, you could check the syntax tree for that specific input, whether there is a cycle or not. Well, that could be, but then you get your error messages only at the point where you actually try to apply your compiler, and that's probably quite the uncomfortable thing to do, and also doesn't help us to make sure that we can guarantee some things. The next thing, which is kind of more helpful, is there to automate the generation of an attribute evaluator for maybe not the general case of attribute systems, but maybe only for certain subclasses. And that's what we're going to look into. Specifically, the subclass of the strongly acyclic attribute dependencies. So that is a special case of attribute systems whose dependency graphs are not only acyclic but strongly acyclic. What does that mean? That means that for all the non-terminals, or so to speak, the inner nodes of the tree, we compute a set of relations. So for non-terminals X, we compute a set of relations between attributes. Sets of relations is something that you have already seen in the slides before. They consist just in these collections of edges between these things, but we don't do that in a precise way, but what we do is we collect an over-approximated version of that, in the sense of the over-approximation of the global dependencies between the root attributes of every production of X. So that is a lengthy sentence, and you probably need a little bit of time to think about that. So conceptually, what you do is you pick each of these nodes that are out there, and try to compute for each of these nodes dependencies between not the the detailed local dependencies or local-like dependencies that you have done before, but just the dependencies between the the attributes for the root node itself. So you ignore the attributes of children or parents or anything. You just project your view on just the particular node. And in order to pay for this reduced view on everything, ignoring parents and children, you consider not precise information, but over-approximated information of the dependencies in there, in the sense that you that if you track or if you mark a dependency between attributes in there, there might be an actual dependency, but as it is an over-approximation of the reality, there might also be cases where there's actually no dependency between them. But to make this whole information useful at all, what you do, what you interpret is if there is no dependency between two attributes in this over-approximation, then there's definitely also no dependency in the real world. So if you approach this over-approximation from the direction relying on the information that there's no dependency, then you don't make an error in that sense. So let's see how far we can work with that. So maybe let's first of all introduce means of actually computing that type of information. So what we do for that is we set up a system to compute these over-approximations. This Rx as the over-approximated dependencies, and we keep them in a similar way as we have done for the local dependencies. So we track these in forms of tuples, where the root is the attribute where the information comes from, and the sink is the attribute where the information goes to.
What we need to do is we need to set up a system that pays respect to the effect that each of the production variants that is out there for the particular non-terminal, that each of these productions has on the over-approximated dependencies of this non-terminal. So in order to compute this over-approximation, we need to incorporate all the effects that all these production variants have. To do so, what we will see is we will have a look at all of the symbols from the right-hand side. Each of them have their own set of over-approximated dependencies that I have cracked somewhere else in my system. And what I do is I pull them into my computation, interconnect the local dependencies that are statically always there, and add the over-approximations for all these children non-terminals into this local dependency graph, and then compress that by looking only onto the transitive hull of all of these connections and cutting away all the children and only looking at the attributes of the root node once again. That might have been quite a lot in the abstract, but we will see it more in detail in the following things. And we do so continually, and thus adding more and more dependencies to these over-approximated sets of dependencies for each of these nodes, until at some point the whole system stabilizes, and it will stabilize at some point. The latest, or the there's kind of natural boundary, as there's only a finite number of attributes, and if they're all interconnected, then we have a stable system, so to say. So there is a natural boundary, but of course we hope that we will reach a stable point, not at the end, but somewhere earlier. So let's introduce a few formal tools for that. I know formalities are always kind of a a very dear thing to have. So what do we actually need? So we need a few tools in order to perform these putting in these dependencies at the correct spots. So what we need for that is we need to introduce these indices with which we denominated the children of a dependency graph, once again back into a dependency graph that doesn't talk about differentiated children and parents anymore, because that is what we need when we add these over-approximated sets into a local dependency graph. The over-approximated sets don't speak about these hierarchy differences anymore, but they need to be plugged into a local dependency graph at the position where the non-terminal was occurring beforehand. So we need to introduce its positional number once again. So that's why we need this redecoration operator. And we do so with this two-array operator. Where's the two parameters for that? Well, one is the set of
of the the edge set, which you take and redecorate. So that is the thing that you find in front. It's this L, and you take relations from that. And the second parameter is the I. That will denote the position in which we desire to plug this relation into the local graph, and this will be used to redecorate the edges so that they kind of fit into the namespace of the local dependency graph. The second tool that we need is kind of doing the contrary thing. Remember me telling about this compression step where we kind of flatten such a dependency graph to just the abstract view on the attributes of only the parent node. That is what we do with a projection. And this is this pi zero operator. This projects everything it finds in there on only the edges that are occurring between the root attributes. And it does so by filtering everything that it gets as parameter for attributes that are expressing relations between root nodes, and only takes them in the final set. So these are kind of contrary operations. One is for puzzling out more complicated dependency trees. The other one is for compressing everything to just one line. We use that in the context of puzzling relations into a local dependency graph. So that's what this thing here is about. So for a specific production P and its and a few other parameters that will be the symbols for the right hand side of a production. What we define here is a kind of an abstract effect that consists in puzzling all that together to one operation. What we will do is we will, in there, especially for this production P, we will emanate from the local dependencies of that particular production and plug in a whole lot of other relations that we take from the parameters over here. We plug them in at specific locations, which we specify here with these parameters, and that all goes into this redecoration thing that we have talked about before. So that is just for making sure that the relations that we put in there land in the kind of the slots where they belong. What we then do is we then do the transitive closure in the sense that we now have the local dependencies and some new dependencies brought into the system from the outside. What we do is we try to connect everything that that is going over several instances of relations to just one relation. So that in the end, if we have one root attribute reachable from another root attribute, we also have a direct relation between them in our set of relations. And then we project away all these boring details that we have added beforehand and only keep the these shortcut edges that we have introduced during this transitive closure phase. Whew. And with that tool now we can do this actual computation of the over-approximated sets, in the sense that in order to compute an over-approximated set of relations for a specific non-terminal X, what we do is we look at all the productions that are out there that expand that specific non-terminal X, and do the union of all the or accumulate in a union all the well, a lot of different sets of dependencies, which are the ones that we accumulate in there. They are obtained by doing this operation of filling in and compacting again after we have performed the transitive hull. And what do we take as input? That's what we see here now. As input, we take all the so far accumulated over-approximated sets of dependencies of the right-hand side symbols of the productions, put them into the locations in the local dependency graph where they actually belong by the structure of the production, perform our chain of operations in the sense that connecting them by bringing them into the same namespace, performing the transitive closure, and then projecting away all the stuff that we don't need, and in the same sense also throw away all these indexes that we have introduced before. And that set of relations is the one now that we accumulate in the Rx directly. So, yeah, that is what we do in the strongly acyclic grammars. Strongly acyclic attribute dependencies sets, and this set of inequalities for the Rx now characterizes these strongly dependencies, and it has a unique least solution that we can compute by fixed point iteration on that thing. So what we do is we step by step fill in these dependencies, compute step-by-step growing sets of dependencies until, in the end, the system stabilizes. And it is guaranteed that this stabilizes as this operation is actually a monotonic operation. In order to then determine whether the grammar that the attribute grammar was now strongly acyclic or not, what we have to do is we have to compute these over approximations for all the productions in the grammar, and all of these over approximations need to be cyclic free for the whole grammar attribute grammar to be strongly acyclic. So, because that was a lot of formulas, let's maybe do that with an example. And the example that we get here is given by a very simple grammar. S goes to L, L goes to A or B, and there's certain dependencies introduced by an attribute system. And in order not to overwhelm you with a lot of formulas over there, we are going to stay on the graphical representations of those things. And yeah, that is the dependency graphs for the particular productions. There is the attributes H, I, and J, and they are somehow connected with each other in a pretty chaotic fashion so far. However, so far we can't directly say what is going to be the whether the whole thing will be acyclic or not. So let's talk about the let's try out our strong acyclicity test. We start by computing the over approximation of the dependencies for L. L has two variants. L goes to A and L goes to B, and we need to perform the union on them, on their respective dependency of approximations. A and B are kind of terminals so far, so they don't contribute any dependencies, so there's no plugging in and projecting and all that. We don't have to deal with that because we only have attributes in the parent part anyway. But what we have to do is we have to perform the union of these dependencies in order to obtain our over approximation of the dependencies, and that's what we're going to do. The transitive closure of all the relations of those are pretty easy, so they're just projecting away every notion of children in there. Then we apply next the union of the whole thing, and this leads to the whole thing collapsing to kind of the system that you see over here, where age is depending on I and J is depending on K. So that is what we consider as the global relations of L. Then let's continue with the next phase. There we need to determine the over approximation of the dependencies for S, and for that we need to consider that there's one right-hand side symbol for which we already have the over-approximation of the dependencies, so we plug that in. So we plug this RL into the local dependencies for S goes to L at the right position. This corresponds to, in the graphical sense, to somehow associate those things to be the same. This you can do by redecorating and embedding this the over approximation for RL by appending the index I to all the relations in the index 1 to all the relations that are kept in this over approximation for L, so that they fit into the namespace of the local dependencies of S. That's looking like this. I think I was too lazy to actually inline the local dependencies also in the formula version, but what you get is in the graphical sense this thing over here, and that what you you would now have to do the transitive closure on, and then throw away everything that relates to the children. So in that sense, if you do so, you will see that you end up with that projection where there's actually no dependency between H and J anymore, and yeah, nothing. So we are through with the computation of all these things. But now, as you have maybe seen, there was this check for cycles kind of button popping up now and then in there, because here we have set up the condition, or we are in the process of setting up the condition that we need to check for a cyclicity anyway. So what we need to do is, in these local dependency graphs, when we have all the stable over approximations of relations in there, we need to plug those over approximations in there and check if there is actually some cycle in there. And you see, at that step, there actually is one that goes over here, 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 and here. That is one
that got projected away afterwards because, well, the cycle didn't carry over into the attributes of the root node. However, it's still there. And if you try to actually evaluate any of the attributes of L in that case, you might run into a circle in there. So we can't guarantee the absence of a circle in that sense, so it's not strongly acyclic in that respect. So, yeah, you might have already read a few things of that slide here because I showed it already. The thing is, with the grammar that we have presented here, it's pretty easy to actually really enumerate all the possible concretely occurring syntax trees, because it's a very finite system. It only has two actual syntax trees, and yeah, an enumeration of two is easily done. And if we do that, we see that that is one of those, and that is the other. And if we check manually for circles in there with, or for cycles in there with our usual means, we see that, well, actually, the left one has only that part of the cycle, and the right one only has that part of the cycle. So, in the concrete enumeration, we see that there's actually not a cycle occurring in all of the possible syntax trees out there, but because, well, we needed to sacrifice some preciseness in there, we compute over approximations of dependencies in there. Thus, we end up with such an such a characterization of the dependencies in the system. So, yeah, we see that that is a typical example for an attribute system which is actually not strongly acyclic, but practically acyclic. So there's no cycle in there, but we can't establish that it is actually strongly acyclic. That is so the property that we are able to compute in reasonable amount of time is actually too strong for a precise notion of acyclicity. But in the cases where the where we can certify for an attribute system that is actually strongly acyclic, then we won't find any practical not any syntax tree at all in which there's actually a cycle in the dependencies. So it's a thing that's still useful if we certify, if we can certify for an attribute system that it's strongly acyclic, then we can definitely find an evaluation strategy that will always work because there's no cycles in there. Good. Yeah. I think that is a point where I wanted to stop right now, because there was one thing that I promised for you, which would be talking about the tutorials that might earn you some kind of bonus on the result of the exam. Since that might not be interested for all of us, I think we could stop the recording now.